Hello. Welcome to the radio edition of this week's episode of Endeavors. This week, we feature interviews with actor and director Paul Moniz de Sa, who will be featured in the upcoming movie The BFG, directed by Steven Spielberg. We also have actress and author Carmen Aguirre. Her new memoir is Mexican Hooker Number 1, and My Other Roles Since the Revolution. And you'll also hear from musician Coleman Hell, and we'll be featuring some songs off his self-titled EP. Enjoy. I am joined on the phone by Paul Moniz de Sa, who is the artistic director at the Arts Umbrella Theater. Paul, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here. So you're the artistic director of Arts Umbrella, but you've actually been associated with that organization for many, many years. I know you first started there when you were a teenager. What was that like? What was that like for you?
First of all, I'm the artistic director of theater and music. There's actually also an artistic director of visual arts and media arts, and an artistic director of dance as well. I'm specifically in the theater and music side of things. I started there as a teenager in 92, I believe, and I actually now teach the program that I first started out as. And I really just wanted something more than what I had in my own high school theater program. I wanted to work with other people that really were interested in the craft. And a friend of mine said she was going to be auditioning for the Arts Umbrella Teen Theater Troupe, which is what it was called back then. And I said, yeah, it's a great idea. And little did I know how much of an effect it would have on my life. But yeah, I was there for 3 years as a student. And then that really gave me the courage to take on acting as a career, and it actually gave me a lot of contacts with, within the theater community as well. I got my first professional theater gig from the people that I met there at Arts Umbrella, and a lot of the students that I went to school with at Arts Umbrella are still in the industry right now too, so it's really great. We still see each other, and we've been, you know, lifelong friends. I then went to train myself, at Studio 58, and then came back as an actor again, but this time as a professional actor working with the students, and then as a sound designer and stage manager, and then finally I started teaching my own classes. And about 7 years ago, I became artistic director of theater and music. So it's been quite the journey for me at Arts Umbrella, and one that's been really quite amazing.
What sort of impact can not just theater, but I guess the type of theater that Arts Umbrella does, what kind of impact can it have on youth that are perhaps trying to find their way in the world?
Well, I think that the thing about it is that, I mean, theater is a very special thing. I think, you know, even when we're looking at watching movies, be it at home or even in a theater, there's kind of that sense that we don't necessarily need to be interacting with anyone else around us. You know, maybe the friend that's right beside you. You know, when you're watching a movie, if you're talking with your friend, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have any effect on what's happening on that screen. But theater itself is, you know, in its essence, it's a collaborative art form. Even a solo show, you know, with one actor on stage, the audience is only seeing that one actor, but the amount of work that goes into creating that piece of work, from the writer who wrote it, from the director who directed it, the designers for the lighting, the costume, the sound, the set, from the stage management that's running all those cues, there are so many people that are involved in putting on a production that I think there's a real sense of belonging and being part of something bigger than just themselves. And I think that's an important part with theater. And then when you have that audience interaction, the reality is every show is going to be slightly different because we're all experiencing that moment together in that at that time, and it will never be quite the same. The energy that the audience is giving the actor is going to have an effect on how the actor is going to deliver those lines or what that actor is feeling in that moment. And those small little changes that's happening in that moment, you know, it doesn't necessarily change the show entirely, but it does it does have an effect. And I think that's the beautiful thing for young actors, to get that chance to take in everybody around them and not just looking at just themselves, but at everything that's happening around them. And I think it's also for a young actor to be able to look at a role and say, okay, well, what does this character want? Who is this character? What's going on with this character? Can I put myself in this character's shoes? And, you know, that's empathy right there, to be able to look at something that I can connect with. And I think that's an important part as well, especially when we're looking at, you know, this day and age where so much is, you know, cell phones or even, you know, people walking around with their best friend and texting each other right then and there. You know, I think that ability to understand and have that want to understand everybody around them and the characters that they're looking at in the play, and that ability to have empathy for all them, and then still be able to take everything in as well. You know, it's a lot harder than people think, but I think it's very rewarding.
And I know for yourself, I'm curious, I know you were born in Zoras, and I'm curious as to how much you think your sort of your family background, and I know you suffered a loss at an early age, about how that plays into your art at all, do you think?
I think it plays a huge part. I mean, it's interesting because I came here when I was about 2 years old. So to some extent, you know, I didn't really live in the Azores for that long. But it was such a huge part of my life. I went back many times in my youth to visit family. My mom didn't even learn English until my dad passed away when I was seven. So that culture was very much steeped in the culture here in Canada. And so, yeah, it did play a huge part. I don't think there are things that, you know, the festivals of the Portuguese church and just things that we do that never we even thought it was different from what anybody else did. It definitely played a huge part. My family is a very big part of my life. I'm the youngest of eight children, and you know, we all still live in the Lower Mainland. We all still get together on a regular basis. I know that any time I have needed somebody in my family, they've always been able to be here for me. And I think there's that, again, that sense of being part of something bigger than just myself, and having to give back to everyone around us. You know, when anything happens in our family, we're all there for each other. And I think that we've all got each other's backs. I think it's an important part. And I think it's one of the things that I also love about theater too. It has that same feeling. If something's happening on stage that, you know, is not quite the way it was meant to be, you know, we've all got each other's backs there too. So I think it's a really, you know, the art form is very much, I think, what my life was like growing up.
So let's talk about a little bit about the Expressions Festival. You've got that coming up starting on May 11th.
Yeah.
And I know you've got a couple of different productions, including, I think I'm reading, The Drowsy Chaperone, Julius Caesar, and even some originals. How did the Expressions Festival start?
It goes beyond just the theater and the music side of Arts Umbrella. It's actually a celebration of all the work that's been done by the students at Arts Umbrella. I love to think of it as a celebration of all things Arts Umbrella. And, you know, there's dance shows happening. There is visual arts shows happening. There's even shows happening within our outreach programs as well. However, the theater and music side is at the Waterfront Theater. And this is something that has started to really grow over the past few years. This year, we really take it to the next step. We have four different companies, basically theater troupes, that are performing for separate shows. And our theater troupes are actually part of our pre-actors audition to get in. They've been training, you know, however, some of these actors have been doing this with us for 4 or 5 years. And they're all working towards putting these shows up. For instance, our junior troupe is doing a show called Story Stew, a Fairy Tale Review. They're actually on tour right now at an elementary school. They're doing their last tour today before they get into the Waterfront Theater. So they've been putting these shows out and bringing them out into the public, and now they get a chance to actually take it to the theater. Last year, we only had 4 days of shows, and this year we've actually gone up to doing 2 weeks at the Waterfront Theater. So really excited to open that up to more audience members to be able to see the work that our young actors are doing, because it's really quite spectacular. As I said, it's the Jazzy Chaperone by our musical theater troupe. The senior troupe, which I direct, we're doing Julius Caesar. Junior troupe is doing Story Stew, a Fairy Tale Review, which is a great theater for young audiences piece. And The Dangers of a Total War, which is an original piece that explores the child evacuees from London to Canada during the Second World War. And that's the piece that has created. And they've had a chance to take it to some schools across the Lower Mainland as well. And now they're bringing that to the Waterfront Theatre. We also have a theatre music showcase, which showcases the work that's being done by students in our intensive programs, which are also year-long, but they meet like once a week, whereas our pre-professional program, we're meeting at least 6 hours a week. Sometimes we're actually doing 10, 15 hours a week of putting this stuff on. So it's been quite different for all of them.
You mentioned Julius Caesar, and you know Shakespeare is not easy at any level. How do you approach that sort of material with a younger group of actors?
Well, you know, the thing about it for me is that when it comes down to it, I mean, one of the things I love about Shakespeare, especially as an actor, is the imagery that actually is in that text. And there's also looking at the text and deciphering what is going on with that character, what does this character want, what are they, what is the imagery behind this text, and what am I letting out, what am I sharing with the audience, what am I sharing with the other characters, how am I getting what I want, and all those things are really, you know, that's the basics of acting as well, too. We have to do that no matter what play we're looking at. But what I love doing with Shakespeare with the younger actors is allowing them to really look at the text and decipher the text. It's almost like, you know, being Sherlock Holmes and going looking at all the clues within the text to decipher what is actually happening here. And as long as we have a good understanding of it, and as long as we, as the actors and the creative team, can look at, you know, what do we want to do here, then I think the audience understands that too, and they get a better understanding of what's going on, and it's all up to interpretation too. You know, this year with Julius Caesar, I decided to look at gender-blind casting, so I have a female Caesar, a female Brutus, a female Cassius, and I thought, this is your chance to take these roles and say, well, how would this be played by a woman, you know? And it's been really wonderful to discover what these young actors have been able to actually put into these roles and how the takes that they're taking on these characters. It's been wonderful to watch them explore that and watch them again discover who these characters are. That's, I mean, really the approach comes down to really deciphering that text and digging deep into what's behind those images and making those images connect in a real way for these young actors. And so it's beyond just saying the lines, but discovering what they really mean to each actor.
And I know that you've also been rewarded theatrically for your work. You've won a couple of Jessies and have been nominated for a couple of others. What is, just for you, what is the award experience like, and what does it mean to you as an actor?
You know, it's interesting. I love the theater community. I really do. And I think the Jesse Richards Awards are a great way to celebrate the work that's actually being done in Vancouver. And, you know, it's always interesting to say, oh, awards, they don't mean anything. But, you know, in the end, I actually felt quite honored to get those awards, you know, and those nominations. Because, my peers looked at my work and thought, you know, hey, great job. And it's interesting because I've also had times where I've had peers that I really respect, or people that, you know, I wouldn't even say are my peers. I would say that they're my mentors, who have come to me and said, you know, I really wish you had actually received a nomination for this, or, you know, and to be honest with you, sometimes that even means more to have, you know, peers and mentors really appreciate the work. That's, I think, for me, the biggest thing. The statue itself, you know, it's lovely and it sits in my office. I think the night is a lovely celebration of what we do here in Vancouver and the Vancouver theater community. In the end, it's nice to be recognized for the hard work.
You mentioned talking about your mentors, and I know now you're a mentor to a lot of youth, both through Arts Umbrella and through your teaching. I think I read that you taught at Douglas, or you used to teach at Douglas. What does that mean to you to now be a mentor to so many others?
You know, it means a lot. I mean, one of the biggest things for me about working at Arts Umbrella and going back to Arts Umbrella was that, you know, for me as a young artist starting out and discovering, you know, that I really did indeed want to do this for the rest of my life, going to Arts Umbrella allowed me to meet people. And as I say, little did I know how much of an impact those people would have. And when I got that chance to work at Arts Umbrella again, even while I was a student there, I got a chance to be an assistant in some classes. I really loved working with, at that time, some of these kids were 6 years old that I was working with as an assistant. And I loved watching them grow and be inspired. And I realized, you know, really these teachers that I had were inspiring me, and I thought I really would like to give back and inspire others. And I like to think that I do that. You never know, but I like that ability to give back, because I don't think I could have done what I have done with my career had I not had those people that were there encouraging me, giving me the courage to really stick it out and audition for Studio 58 and give me the confidence that this is something that I could do with my life, and giving me the opportunities to perform and share my art. And I think that's a big part. Opportunities are a huge thing. And so now that I get to be a mentor, I look for different opportunities that my young actors can also share their art, you know, get a chance to, you know, perform even more than just, you know, one or two nights, but get a full run in to see what that's like. It's wonderful to now see so many of my my students are now professional actors, and so many of them right now are even going into post-secondary education, going into the Studio 58s and being accepted into there, or National Theatre School or Concordia, or schools across North America, really. I like to think I had a hand in making that possible for them. It really comes down to them, you know, and what they do with it all. But it is wonderful to get that chance.
Sorry. Speaking of opportunity, I know early on in your career, when you were first starting out with Arts Umbrella, you had a chance to, you were a recipient of their bursary program. And I know a lot of art schools and theater schools do that. How important is that in terms of helping kids get to where they need to be by offering, you know, financial assistance or financial rewards? I think in some circles there seems to be like, oh, you know, it's a bad thing that these kids have to have assistance.
Well, you know, in the end, a wonderful program that we have at Arts Umbrella, and I think it's a very important program that we have at Arts. People think, well, I can't do this because I don't have the money. And eliminating matter, if you would like to train, if you would like to do this, there is that possibility. It helps alleviate some of those stresses. Also, on the family, the bursary program helped, but, you know, my brothers and my sisters also helped pay for my time at Arts Umbrella as well. So I think having that ability to say, okay, the financial aspect is not going to be a hurdle that you have to go over in order to do what you love and explore this as a real viable option. Because I think whether they become professional actors, whether or not they become doctors or nurses or, baristas for that matter, it goes a long way in discovering, I think, who we are as people when we are training as actors and who we are deep down and how we can react with other people and how we can, go on a job interview and be able to present ourselves in a way that says, this is who I am, and be proud of that. And I think that bursary program is essential because some of those kids, really, when they don't have that, when they get lost in the systems, they can get lost themselves. And I think that is a very good thing.
And finally, speaking of opportunity, what are you able to tell us about the BFG and the Spielberg experience?
Well, that would be for a whole other interview. I can say this. That was wonderful. It was an amazing experience that I think I'm very lucky to have been part of. There are tremendous people on that piece from all over the world coming to work on the BFG. The trailers look absolutely wonderful, and I just can't wait till that comes out.
And that comes out, I believe, July the 1st.
Yeah, July the 1st.
The Expressions Festival at Arts Umbrella runs from the 11th to 22nd of May. I've been speaking with Paul Moniz de Sa, the Artistic Director of Theater and Music at Arts Umbrella. Paul, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Alrighty, have a good one. Ciao.
You too. Bye.
That was actor and theater director Paul Moniz de Sa. This is our first selection from Coleman Hell's self-titled EP. This is Thumbelina. I wanna take you with me. Thumbelina from Coleman Hell off his self-titled EP. Now, here's my chat with the man himself, electropop artist Coleman Hell. I'm joined on the phone by Coleman Hell. Coleman, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you've got a new self-titled album out. I understand this is your first sort of full-length LP. How did you know that this one was going to be longer?
Quick correction: I have a self-titled EP out. I have like a debut LP coming out just before summer. But what's released? I released it late last year. It's an EP, about 5 songs.
So what's the process like for you of putting an album together in terms of your writing process?
Well, I think the album I'm getting set to release, my process was I think finding myself in an emotional state and then trying to write as many songs as I could in sort of like a shorter period of time when I was feeling that way, feeling all those things, and then now trying to make sense of it and piece together something that has like a cohesive feeling and theme. So at the time I was in a kind of like problematic relationship. And I was also sort of, I'd been living in Toronto for about 5 years, and I'd finally sort of reconnected with the small town I grew up in, Thunder Bay, Ontario, and the kind of music I heard when I lived there, and the kind of life I lived when I lived there. So I sort of mixed all that together, and I went out to a cabin with my friends, and I wrote and recorded a bunch of songs for, I don't know, maybe over a month, and I've just been kind of like producing them and tweaking them and getting ready to put them out into the world.
I read this in your letter and I got to ask about it. Your love of Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And is it true that you actually in your writer you say you want a printed photo of her in your dressing room?
This is true, yeah. And if you don't have a printer, you have to draw one by hand.
What is it about Julia that you admire or that you like, however you want to phrase it?
I don't know. I grew up watching a lot of sitcoms with my parents. I have a song about sitcoms too. But Seinfeld was always my favorite. I think I just connected to her because I like girls with like a good sense of humor. Like I like how she's so sarcastic, and she's kind of like the proto hipster chick with like the long flower dresses and the funky curly hair. So that kind of gets me going too.
Of course, girls are a popular subject of song. And Julia seems like she'd be a good target. Do you think you would ever maybe write an ode to Julia Louis-Dreyfus?
Oh yeah, for sure. If I could get her in a music video or something, that would be amazing.
Yeah, there you go, right?
Yeah.
So you mentioned I think you mentioned Thunder Bay there. What was it like for you growing up in that sort of environment, you know, the North, relatively small? How would you say that it affected your maybe writing style or music sensibilities at all?
Well, there's a number of different things, I think, that I drew from there. Being that far isolated from everything else, most of the stuff I heard growing up was either my parents' music or on the one radio station that was around when I was younger, which was like a classic rock station. So a lot of my early exposure to music was old music, old rock music, old Motown music, soul, folk, country, that kind of stuff. So that's what I heard growing up. So I think even though I'm an electronic artist, that's typically where I draw inspiration from, is like music from the 70s and the 80s. Also, I think I grew up playing in a lot of, like, in a bar scene. There's lots of local bands and stuff, and a lot of them were kind of, like, rootier, rockier bands, too. So, I mean, for an electronic artist, I think growing up in Thunder Bay, I wasn't as influenced by other electronic music. I was more inspired by old music and rock and folk.
I think electronic music, whether it's, analog or EDM, drum and bass, it's really taken off within the last 5 to 10 years, I think, as technology has progressed. How do you explain this sort of newfound love for sort of the new era electronic music that we're seeing these days?
Why
do you think electronic music is sort of all the rage right now, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I could tell you why I gravitated to it. It was because I didn't have to rely on 3 or 4 other people to meet for an hour every day after school and rehearse with me. I could just go in my room, put my headphones on and play keyboard, and I could do it for 6 hours or 8 hours or as long as I wanted to. So being kind of my own band was really liberating. And also just, I think the more disconnected people are with each other, making music isolated like that, like for introverted people that are typically interacting with people through like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter or whatever, it's kind of just like, I don't know, it makes more sense to just make music on your own or make it with a friend or something on your computer. I think it's kind of the like atmosphere or landscape of artists right now.
You've mentioned isolation a lot.
It's like it's relatively inexpensive or almost doesn't cost any money too, I guess.
Right, yeah.
There's lots of reasons why I think people make electronic music.
You were talking about isolation there for a couple of times, and I'm curious as to whether you think, in your case, isolation spurred creativity, like how those two go hand in hand.
Definitely, yeah. I personally, like, when I'm writing lyrics or thinking about all of these stuff, I have like friends and roommates who I write music that I'm comfortable with, but typically I want to be either with 1 or 2 people or completely alone when I'm writing music, and I think of most of my ideas by myself. I don't know. I think, yeah, for me, isolation was maybe a big thing in the beginning, and I still sort of stick to that. I don't like going to big studios or anything either. I like making music in my living room or in my bedroom.
At the top of the just before we got on the air here, you said you were, I think, driving on your way to Cleveland. What do you enjoy the most about being on the road?
Well, I mean, up until late last year, I hadn't really traveled too much at all in my life, really. So getting the opportunity to see all these places I've always wanted to see and having, you know, a legitimate reason to go there too, so I don't feel like I'm just, you know, I have a purpose. I'm there for a reason. I'm meeting real people from these places, so it's exciting. I think that's probably it, anyways.
Yeah.
I see so many different places and connect with different people.
Is every audience different? You know, is like a Midwestern audience different than a Eastern Canadian audience, for example?
Yes and no. I think there are like specific like stereotypes about certain parts of the world. Like specific audiences are tougher and whatever. But then, you know, you'll play a show. Like, I'd always heard that like LA audiences were really sort of nonchalant and sort of tougher to win over. And then I played in LA last year with Robert DeLong, like the crowd was so into it and crazy. So I think it just depends. I'm sure that like some of those things ring true, but
we'll see you soon.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Alrighty, ciao.
Okay, bye bye.
That was Coleman Hell. His EP is self-titled. This is his track, After Hours.
That's what it is. Like, After Hours is just moments. Moments in time, you know? It feels so great and everything's clicking and music is perfect. And when you leave, it's like you're pulling a parachute, right? And you just jump. And if you take, like, some go home or whatever like that, it's not going to work out, man, for the night. You know, you're not going to find love at the fucking hours.
That was After Hours by Coleman Hell. My final guest is both an award-winning actress, theater director, and an award-winning author. Her debut memoir, Something Fierce, won Canada Reads back in 2012. She now has a follow-up entitled Mexican Hooker Number 1 and My Other Roles Since the Revolution. She is Carmen Aguirre. This is our conversation. I am joined on the phone by Carmen Aguirre. Carmen, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a new book out, Mexican Hooker Number 1, and My Other Roles Since the Revolution. And I'm curious, you know, since Something Fierce came out and won all the accolades that it did, how soon after that all wound down did you realize you had more to tell?
Oh, no, I always knew that I had more to tell. I always knew that Something Fierce wouldn't be my only book, that I would probably write a few others.
And, you know, given your success as a playwright, what was it like for you to do a book? How different was that process?
Playwriting I find harder than prose, just because it's so limiting and constrained. I think it's akin to poetry or comic book writing. Everything that I've learned from 25 years of playwriting, I put into writing both the books. So it wasn't as difficult as one would think.
Had it ever crossed your mind to do these stories as theater pieces, or did you always know that they were going to be books?
Yeah, there was a moment there when I always knew they were going to be books, because there's such dense stories and there's so much information that, again, if we go back to the other question, there's no way that all of that would have fit into one play.
This is a pretty powerful story. How hard was it for you just, you know, revisiting that part of your life and going over all of the details that came with this story?
It was only hard from the writing point of view, because I wasn't writing for personal catharsis. I had already healed from the traumas that I speak about in the book. I was writing more for universal experience. So it was only hard from the point of view of structure, right? Structuring the book so that it made sense the way that I wanted it to make sense, right? Where, in terms of the rape, I refer to it early on in the book as an undealt with trauma that is always orbiting in the sky like a satellite until it crashes into you. So I wanted the structure of the book to reflect that.
The decision to meet your meet the man who did this to you, what played into that decision?
I was raped by the paper bag rapist, who's actually called John Horace Outen, when I was 13, and I never saw him at the time. So, you know, he covered my face with my own shirt, so I literally never saw him. Then I never went to trial because I never saw him, and the rape kit that was done on me the day of the rape was lost, so couldn't be used as evidence. Also, I was out of the country when the trial happened, so I never went to the trial. Then the parole hearings began. The parole hearings had been going on for a while, but it was only in 1995 that a bunch of us victims started to go to them. And I would see him there, which was the first time I saw him, but usually from behind or the side of his face. So I had never had the opportunity to look into his eyes. So it was a natural progression that 33 years after the rape, I would go and meet face to face with him for 5 hours and have the opportunity to look him in the eye and even out the power imbalance between us.
When you finally got to look him in the eye and go through that experience, what sort of emotions were going through your head?
I was expecting absolutely nothing from him because he is a psychopath. In other words, he feels no remorse. So I wouldn't say I was going through emotions. I was just very interested to look him in the eye and have a conversation with him.
I also feel that this book is very timely, given, you know, all the conversations that we're having about assault and survivors. We just recently had the Gomeshi trial. A lot, you know, Cosby's going on. What do you make of where that conversation is these days in terms of you know, rape and women's rights and all that?
I mean, I think it's a very, very necessary conversation. I think it's great that we're having it. In terms of my experience, I was a child, so I was not a woman, so I don't see it as my experience. I don't see it so much as a women's rights issue because I was a child, and he did attack boys as well as girls. And I've had a lot of people writing me ever since the book came out and all the publicity around it, telling me about their own stories, and some of those people are men who were attacked as children. So I think it's amazing that we're having the conversation about women's rights. I don't know that this particular case has everything to do with that, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Right. You know, I'm also curious when I talk to artists and actors about, you know, they say for acting that you need to have, you know, you need to have a lot of experience, as you know, life experience, as it helps you grow as an actor. And I'm curious, with everything that you went through, from this to the revolution in Chile, how that maybe drew you towards a life in the arts, if you think it did at all.
It has nothing to do with that. I knew that I wanted to be an actor since I was 3 years old. It was my calling. And, you know, I believe that we all have enough life experience to be actors. You know, they say that I think by the age of one, you have felt every emotion there is to feel. And, you know, I'm a mother of a 9-year-old boy, and I certainly witnessed that. So it's just a question of tuning your instrument, which requires a lot of training, to have access to all those emotions and experiences.
But do you find at all that the arts can heal us in ways that maybe other areas of life can't?
I think the arts can be very healing for the audience. If you are doing art, if you are making art in order to heal yourself as some part of as a part of some kind of personal healing, I don't believe that that is art. I believe that that is journaling or having a conversation with your own pain, which is very valid. But that's not necessarily for public consumption. So yes, it's healing for the people who it's meant for, which is not to say that when you are creating art, you're not feeling things. Of course you are. But if the reason you're doing it is to heal something, then I would call that therapy.
So on that note, you know, and about healing for the audience, you know, what would you want people who read this book and other survivors who read this book, what would you want them to take out of this? If anything.
Oh, I mean, yeah, no, I wouldn't be so arrogant as to think that, you know, my writing is meant for other people to take something out of. But, you know, if they feel identified, if they're entertained by the story, then that's great.
And now I know, in addition to this book, you're also working, I read, on 3 new plays. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah, next week I'm going to the Banff Playwrights Colony to work on one of them, which is called Broken Tailbone. It's a one-woman show, and it's with audience participation. So basically the concept of the show is that I teach the audience how to dance salsa. And as I'm doing that, I tell them the history of Latino dance halls in Canada. I talk about geopolitics in terms of North and South relations, and I tell personal stories about my own experiences in the Latino dance halls in Canada. One of the other ones is called Anywhere But Here, and I've been developing that through the Playwrights Theatre Centre here in Vancouver, and that one takes place at the U.S.-Mexico border, and it's a magic realist play, and it's about the quest for home. And then the third one, which I've kind of got in the back burner and will probably stay there for a while just because of time issues, is another one-woman show called The Trial of Tina Modotti, which is about this very famous 1920s photographer called Tina Modotti, who gave up her art in order to go fight in the Spanish Civil War. And she ran a hospital in Madrid for the Republicans. She was, you know, she worked alongside Norman Bethune when he was doing blood transfusions. Her ambulance driver was Ernest Hemingway. So really amazing character whose life I want to explore.
You know, given how political a lot of your work is, and given that you were a big part of the revolution in the 70s, I'm curious about your thoughts about sort of this new political revolution that we're hearing about in the States with Bernie Sanders and everything that's going on in that regard.
Well, I mean, first of all, I completely support Bernie Sanders, and I think it's fantastic that the Occupy movement found somebody to, see as their leader, for lack of a better term, because I think a lot of the young people, a lot of the people in general who are going to his rallies and who are going to vote for him come from the Occupy movement. And those are people who might not have voted for anybody before. So the fact that they're actually thinking of voting because of him and they're going to vote for him, I think is great. Do we live in a utopia? Of course not. We live very far from a utopia. So, yes, in a utopia, we wouldn't even have a system to vote for. It would all be, fantastic without any kind of political system where we have to vote. But because we're very far from that, I think it's great to support somebody like him. And I hope that we have somebody like that in Canada soon.
Well, the book is called Mexican Hooker Number 1 and My Other Roles Since the Revolution. It's definitely a powerful and inspiring story. I encourage all the listeners to read it. Carmen Aguirre, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great talking to you.
Alrighty, take care.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
That was my chat with actress and author Carmen Aguirre. Her new memoir is Mexican Hooker Number 1 and My Other Roles Since the Revolution. That just about does it for the show this week. My thanks to Carmen Aguirre, Paul Moniz de Sa, and Coleman Hell. For a longer, unedited version, you can check out our website at podswithbenefits.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Endeavors Radio. If you like the show, please consider donating. That'd be very, very cool of you. We're going to take you out with Coleman Hell's sitcom. Thanks for tuning in. And we'll see you next week, everybody. Bye, everybody. Bye.
Honey, I'm home. How was work? I got dinner on the stove. You call this dinner? This is why we all get thinner. It's alphabet soup, so you can eat your words. Whoa-oh, they're laughing at me again. I heard God's a stand-up comedian. He's got a special on HBO, and he does a lot of racial jokes. 5 stars from the critics, but when I tell my jokes, I get crickets. Go figure, I'm just another hack with a sitcom laugh track playing in the backpack. Dysfunctional family sit so calmly while they bask in the light of a TV screen. And have you ever dreamed that you laughed until you cried, and then you cried until you screamed? Whoa-oh, they're laughing at me again. I heard God's a stand-up comedian. He's got a special on HBO, and he does a lot of racial jokes. 5 stars from the critics, but when I tell my jokes, I get crickets. Go figure, I'm just another hack with a sitcom laugh track playing.